I take this seriously. This is the format that I was accustomed to when I first came in the program, and this month is kind of special because I came into OA in April 30th of 1980, and so that's a long time, you know, and thus I want to let go right now that I'm afraid I won't be profound enough, and because after all, and so it's just my ego talking, so anyway, I came in this program because I was purging 10 times a day, and I was doing laxatives, and I was working out 3 times a day, and drinking quite a bit, and totally lost and broken when I found this program. And so today, fast forward all these years, I eat relatively normal within my abstinence, which is no purging, first of all, no laxatives, keeping my food in, and not eating sugar. And that is something that is evolved, and no alcohol too, and that and balance in the other areas. But that has evolved over the years. And I want to preface this too that we talk about for newcomer. This is not a cult, you know. Because that's what I thought when I came in here. When we recite everything and go through the meeting format, but when I came in here, I was very. Nervous. I wanted what people had, but I didn't want any of you, and I surely didn't want to keep coming back. That has all changed today. And one of the things I heard very early on that made me think it was a cult was they talked about spiritual experiences, and I thought, oh boy. And I think I had something like that today, which is just so amazing, because what recovery has done for me is opened my eyes to witness the miracles. I was blinded to them when I first came in, and over the years I get to see profound changes in who I was and who I could have been and who I would have been had I stayed in my disease if I was even here. And what that was for me is my mom died in 2002, and she was not the reason, but she was the person that inspired all my rage. Her actions, her lack of actions, it was always focused on her, and in retrospect, that was true. You know, there's a lot of dysfunction in my family, and she was the main one. Later I found out she had our disease too, but I didn't know. Back then we didn't have the terminology. And when she died, I was relieved for her, even though it really hurt, because she could never find peace of mind in our world. And I was kind of relieved. I have not missed her, because it was so much, not animosity, because when we had fun and when she was in a good place, it was lovely, but when she wasn't, it was awful. And I was sitting today and I teared up. I missed her. I really missed her. All the cool parts about her and the parts when she wasn't in her illness. And why that's so profound is because coming to 12-step programs, not just this one, I dip in all of them, that the program allowed me, first of all, to get sober, come into touch with the pain that I had, be able to do something about the pain, get the relief so that I could discover who I am, and then come around, it's like a full circle, have the capacity to appreciate and love her for who she was, as imperfect as she was. That's not what I came in here for. I just wanted to stop the food, you know. It was so out of whack. So saying that, I'm just really moved by that, because there's been so many other miracles in my life that I never anticipated. I never thought that far ahead. I just wanted to stop being driven by the food, and that's all I thought about. That's all I did. Having that, I was forced to compromise myself and my spirit and my morals on every level. And, you know, when in the addiction, it does not care. It does not care about anything and anybody, including myself. And I was so lost at that time that I felt like if I didn't have my thinness, I had nothing for this world to offer, because there was nothing else going on, or so I thought. That was my truth. Today I know that not to be true. So I just want to do a brief thing, and I haven't done this before, thinking about it. And normally I don't use notes really, but I wanted to just give a real bit of history. So it's about the food, but it's about my life and how I showed up in life and why I turned to food. So my parents were both born in Indonesia, and they were Dutch Indonesian, so half-breeds, kind of cool. Considered kind of a half-breed, known as an Indo, which I've always taken great pride in. They grew up in Jakarta, and life was very idyllic, and it was lovely until the Japanese came in and supported an uprising amongst the Indonesians. At that point, life came to an abrupt halt, the good life, and a lot of brokenness happened as of that afterwards. And shortly after, there was some prison camp stuff, there was some ugly things that happened, and then anybody that was Indo descent had the option, at least if I understand it right, to leave the islands, leave everything that they had there. And so my parents separately, around age 19, went to the Netherlands, and they were it was those long boat rides, a month or so. My dad, it was an adventure. My mother, it was horrific. They came to Holland, and so, you know, the cold, the wet, the damp, and the white people, and my parents were a tad darker, but not really, but still felt on the outside. They're recovering from the whole invasion, the war at that time, so all these people coming over from the boats were not wanted, so my parents were not wanted there. But they were able to rise above, create a life. Very difficult. So the point that I guess I want to make as far as this is that everything that was safe and stable was ripped apart, and then there were years where there wasn't any place, any of that stability happening. And I see now in retrospect how my mom was seeking that. They got there, they created a life. My dad went to medical school, he got TB, was put in a sanitarium, and my mom had was pregnant three times, no money, and she aborted two of the babies, and I was kept. I was the middle one, and I was kept, which also has fed my disease, my mind. And then once life got a little bit easier, we got transported to New Hampshire, another cold country of a whole different mentality. The way they talk about in Indonesia, everybody was so warm and family and loving and happy, and that was ripped away, as far as my mom was concerned, for the rest of her life here on earth. So we go to New Hampshire, and now she's got two more babies. So it's three of us. I'm 5 and a half. And we come there, and she doesn't speak English. My dad's a doctor. She's got three babies, six and under. Snow, no driver's license, no language skills. And the reason the compassion I had for her today when I was thinking about that is like, holy cow, you know, this disease is what makes me feel that way. You know, I no language skills to talk about how I feel, no right to feel the way I do. Everything, including the weather, traffic, etc., is insurmountable. Can't talk about what I'm feeling, so alone, so alone in this food. And so there was a compassion for her that, and an empathy that I couldn't get to because I was so wounded. We lived there, and I became the helper. And at that point, my personality shut down. I had to help with the kids, and there was no father around, really, because he was out there working for us. But as a kid, I didn't know that. And then we had another child. So I was very good at helping and doing and anticipating and being emotionally available. And because of the language barrier, my mom didn't have any friends. And if she did, the interpretation, she'd get wounded so fast that it became just the family. Fast forward, I go 18, people go to college then. And so it was so profound when I got to school that it was the first time I really thought that everybody else got that 101A life, how you do life book. You know, people were picking directions, majors, they had sports, they want a date, they had a sense of excitement about life. Clueless. The emptiness, the emptiness made it a ripe field for me to start practicing my addiction. And so between not, being afraid and being angry, because I felt so ill-equipped, the bulimia was just waiting for me. They talk about a predisposition for this disease, and in retrospect, that's what I had. I wanted something to, you know, I still battle this desire to numb out, anesthetize, take me away. I'm not enough. I'm different. You guys, you know, it's always you guys know something I don't, and trying to catch up or to figure that out, and feeling embarrassed and ashamed. This disease is so much of shame. So God forbid anybody find out that I don't know, and I never learned how to ask. You know, how do you do this? Especially when everybody seems so ept, and I felt so inept. So because of the intensity of growing up, I was so happy to meet people for dinner and lunch and to have that community, because I never had that. I had to stay home all the time. I never had friends come over to my house, ever, all growing up. The door was closed, and it was very secretive. So going to college and then people hanging out having coffee, which never has left me since then, of community was just wonderful, wonderful. And that's where my disease suddenly came about. The first time I purged, I had just been there too long, eaten too much, and it was so innocent. I went back to my dorm, and I don't know, it just happened. And so what I've learned from that, as I hear people's stories, some people it's an innocent entry into their lives. Other people it's very manipulated, calculated. For me, I was just like, whoa, what was that? And some time passed. I didn't tell anybody, because who tells people that? And where do you tell people? And why do you tell people that? And actually, it was not a problem, I thought. It happened again after some time, and maybe some time passed, it happened again. And I think in the big book, it talks about the insidiousness of this disease. Had it come on full force, I think I would have been able to ask for help in some way. But because it was so subtle, I didn't know what hit me. And I found it also, which is part of my personality, I want to get something for nothing. I find that I want to get it without being responsible or accountable. I don't know, I get a rush off of that, you know, I still do. But now I'm a lot kinder to me, and I can take ownership. But then it was like, what the hell is this? You know, so all of a sudden I figured I discovered something, because again, I was still thin, I was athletic, that was my, how I showed up in life, how people knew me, and what I wanted them to think. It wasn't too long after that something flipped, and for those who've heard my story before, I just want to apologize, because I just think, when you tell your story this many times, you think, well, it's got to get boring, but it is the story. So there's a time where it flipped in to, it wasn't a choice. It was something different, where staying at the cafeteria now was, that was the effort I needed to do to go back so I could purge. The purging worked in a lot of ways. I was so angry, but I didn't have to deal with my anger. If you piss me off, I could purge, and I didn't have to deal with you either. I never learned those skills. If I felt lost, it gave me relief. It gave me relief that I had never found in anything else, and I was so grateful in a way. And so it was my little secret. And then when it turned, when I started having to actually practice eating and going, is when the darkness started coming in. And every time this happened, I thought it was the worst it ever was. And my history was it could only get worse. It only could get worse, and I could get so creative in how worse it could get. So in college, nobody knew about this. Second school I went to, I came out in the health service, and they put me on medication, epileptic medication to stop. They thought it was a brain disorder. It was, but not the one they measured for me. So fast forward, those were horrific years. I ate my way through and grew by leaps and bounds when I went to Europe with a backpack. I outgrew my clothes, just frightening. I started seeing a difference in my pattern where I could control the food for a long time, and then I couldn't control it, and then your food, I'd have to go into that, and in the store, and then I started writing bad checks, and then when I got those little fees about for writing a bad check, that number started growing. And so typically for me is, you know, if you can't do anything about it, then you'd ignore it. I mean, that makes logical sense to me. So I'm sorry I'm doing that. That is really not what I'd like to be doing, but apparently I'm still doing it, so I'll just block it out. Done that a lot in my life, too, and the steps have helped me through that. Came into OA in 1980, through Dear Abby ad, came in the meeting, thought it was a cult, and I say that because it almost made me leave. I thought, who are these people? But I heard people talking about food and hope in a way that penetrated somewhat. I didn't have much in my life at that time. I was about ready to lose a bunch of things, including a job. And so I had nowhere to go, and I had no money, so I kept coming. I don't think I started my first inventory or completed that until 2 years in the program. I just came in and started crying and never thought I'd stop. And I continued crying for over 2 years. Like really crying, noticeably, annoyingly in the meetings. But I just felt like there was an acceptance. I did feel like I was sicker than everybody else, and they talked about what to do. Back then they said if you didn't want to eat, put the big book in one hand and the phone in the other. And I thought, so, and your point is, you know, because I'd stop using utensils. I kept going to meetings, what they said, and I share this now because I went to a lot of meetings. I went to 2 meetings a day, and on the weekend I lived at meetings, and if it wasn't OA, then it was ACA, Al-Anon, AA, anywhere that gave me space from the food. I got abstinent after I realized that I really didn't want to be abstinent. I just wanted this hell to stop. You know, I did not want... I was so afraid if I didn't eat and purge and get rid of this, what would happen? I was going to explode and somebody might be in my way. Because that was when I was spending $50 a day, some days, and this is 1980, so I can only imagine, and throwing it all up. And I didn't have the money to begin with. And running 3 times a day and doing... X-lax and all those things, and then drinking in between. It still chokes me up sometimes because it was so awful existence. And then when you guys offered abstinence, and I thought, well, I felt so guilty and shameful there because I didn't want it. I couldn't give it up. And they said, you don't give it up. Your higher power removes it. You just need to keep showing up. And that sounded like such a bunch of crock. But I did go because I had nowhere else to go. It took me 9 or 10 months of ugly eating. I get breaks and then I go back, and then I get a longer break and then I go back for a shorter time. Then I go back, get a break for a shorter time, then binge for a long time. They kept saying if you just show up, they'll be there for the miracle. And that's what happened. One Sunday after a retreat, which usually was horrific in terms of the purging, I realized that there was a little bit of me that didn't want to follow through, and I hung on like this. It got uglier because without the food anesthetizing, I did shine through, and as a nutcase, you know, a really nice, pathetic nutcase, I ate for a reason. You know, it's not just about my thighs. It's not just about the food. I had all these... tormentors and monsters in my brain, and inside there was such a scared little kid, and did not know how to ask questions, did not know where to go, did not know if anybody had the answers, and did not know what to do if I exposed those. I did not know how to step into the next thing. This disease is one of fear and shame, and I really identify with that. I got abstinent that time in January of the following year, and the way my abstinence works is I call them three last suppers. They were huge meals, and I didn't eat between, but I drank a hell of a lot of coffee, tab, gum, anything else I could do. I didn't drink water. I don't think I believed in it at that time. But I ate these huge meals, and they were the same food every day. And I ate no carbs and no sugar. And after 2 months of that, I gave up alcohol because I couldn't. I don't care about abstinence if I'm drinking. And the sugar made me not want abstinence. But the beauty of that was when the sugar was out of my system long enough, I wanted more. And so that's where I really, if you can eat sugar in your food plan, yay you. I turned into a green-eyed monster with 2 heads, you know, and green stuff coming out of pores. I could not work this program until I'd had some time with that. It was not pleasant. I hung on, I cried, and I carried my salad for a family of five. You don't mess with my food, and it was the same thing. I did that for a long time, thinking it would be like that forever, accepting it would be like that forever, and it's not like that today. But I had to be willing to do that, and I see a lot of people lately going back out, and I don't see that willingness, and I don't know why I had it. I could never commit to anything before. But I just want to say that out loud, to get abstinent and to get a grip of what's available in this program, for a while it can be ugly, and that's okay. My pride would get in there. I have a life, after all. I don't know what that was, but I thought I had a life. I put everything on hold. It was just about program for a long time. 3 years in the program, the despair and the hopelessness of why I ate came through, and I ended up in the mental hospital. And they helped me with my rage. It was a beautiful thing. Because in the Big Book, it talks about their outside resources. Don't be embarrassed. I thought I wasn't doing this right. And I've not done any of this program right except keep coming. Then I did what I did next, and I talk about in the Big Book, we don't have relationship, we take hostages. I took my husband hostage and got married. That made sense. When that was having trouble, why not having a child? That makes sense. I mean, it's just, watching a higher power's grace in my life is just amazing. I mean, I just F it up. I just do, with good intentions. It makes so much sense. We were reading the other day about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, and that is so like this for me. And even today, I'm so grateful that I know to check out my thinking, because it seems so right at that moment. And then a few minutes later, I'm like, how did I even get there? And so the humility and the self-acceptance today allows me to look at that. But those early years were brutal. It took me a long time to do that first inventory, because I couldn't figure out how to hold a notebook. I did, and which pen, So every step has been like that. It's been really, really difficult. I have worked with a lot of sponsors and a lot of people. There aren't a lot of sponsors in this program, and even when we're talking about who's available, I go like this, because the people that do sponsor have a lot of people calling them. And so, and there was nobody that had enough time for me. Sometimes I would forget that people come in this program because life isn't working, not because they're a therapist waiting for me to call them. And so what I have done with that, and over the years it evolved, is I have a team. I have a lot of people that know me and know my stuff, so that I'm not a burden to anybody. Because when my stuff happens, I need a lot of help. And so that, I just put that out there, because there's a lot of people floating in and out of this program and around this program that go, nobody has time for me. Nobody had time for me either. But there's so many cool people that have a lot to offer here, and they have saved my life. So I have been going to meetings and doing a lot of service over the last few years, and tonight we thought there was only going to be 4 or 5 of us here, and we decided that we're not doing this next year because nobody comes. So, funny God, as everybody shows up. And so, it just shows me how my thinking gets me nowhere. Today I still go to 3 or 4 meetings a week, at least. I'm on the phone a lot. Sometimes I think that's an addiction, whatever. My food changed about 2 or 3 years in. I brought carbs back in, like bread and such, which at the beginning I could not handle. I could not handle any kind of carbs. And today, as long as I stay in the brown realm, I can eat pretty much anything. I prayed for the desire to... I mean, I used to cry when the desserts came out and everybody got all excited, because I wanted to have that whoopie-doo feeling and to be one of them, and then have the nice stemware with whatever red or white in there. And today that doesn't call to me most of the time. It has in the last year a couple times, because it looks so romantic, and it looks whatever. But then I have that tool of pause, which has just been a lifesaver, going, I can actually, when I was in the food, or before I found recovery, once I put it in, I couldn't remember that later on I'd be this big. I just couldn't make that connection. Today I can, and today there's a lot of gratitude that I'm really healthy as a result of this program. And so what used to be poor me, they can do, they can have, I can't. Today I'm like, wow, thank you, God, because I can be way more than a lot of people my age, which is, I'm amazed. I wouldn't have done it for that reason, but that's the gift today. A couple years ago, I shared that something really weird happened. You know, in your 50s, everything goes down. You know, what pointed out is not, what was up is down. You know, things move that didn't. And so that it goes totally contrary to my belief system of worthiness, and I fell in love with my body. And it's not like I sit there and look at it. I mean, I don't have that much pleasure, but I wasn't preoccupied with, okay, if your thigh's bigger, then I will put my leg up, or this, or wear certain clothes, or think that you are thinking about my feet, my calves, or all that self-obsession. It was just like, thank you that it works. Thank you that it works. And what happened when that obsession was kind of let go of, it makes room for other stuff. You know, when I first came in the program, and those idiots outside this program, they said, well, instead of eating and doing that, why don't you do something else? And I said, like what? There was nothing satisfying except my sickness. There was nothing. It was like, I used to say it was better than a good man, you know, because it was always there. It knew exactly how to cater to my needs, etc. Why would, you know, and today I have hobbies. I have things that actually bring satisfaction. And really lately, other things that were for grown-ups, you know, I was very mature, so I had to have immediate gratification, things that zing me, you know, to cute, cool, that kind of stuff. New is very, anything new, you know, that is titillating. I can actually sit through stuff and enjoy things that I hadn't before. Also, something new is that I don't have to have my headphones all the time when I just walk now. That I used to have to. And the music at home has to be on. And I've caught myself a number of times lately sitting quiet. The sound of quiet used to just give me a headache. I just needed noise. I needed constant something. Constant help me to not be present. And, you know, and so what's so cool about this is I appreciate the shaking heads, because out there people go, huh? You know, great, good for you. You know, I'm glad, whatever. And so I'm also, I'm dating myself right now. I decided to marry me. Now, I've been married for 30 years, and I have 3 kids, and I've been able to stay abstinent through all that. It was weird, but I was able to do that. And also able to be present for them. I also tell people that I was their walking blanket. None of my kids had a blanket, because there it was on 2 feet walking next to them. So I've been other-oriented for a long time. And so I decided to spend a year or so and just be with me. So because I have, through this program, you meet so many cool people. I mean, I just believe that. People that know how to laugh, how to feel, how to be present, how to care. And so I'm trying to do things without asking anybody, just with myself, and it's been delightful. And that's another gift this program has given. Also creating a space to find out what the next chapter is. And for somebody who couldn't find satisfaction in anything or any direction, and nothing was enough, and everything's too much, and I'm lazy, and I probably got it wrong, and probably you don't like me, and or I should, you know, if I'm doing something I shouldn't be, because that's what spiritual people do. If I'm not doing something, God, what a lazy ass, you know, get going. Not a no-win world, that has subsided somewhat. And so I guess I'll close with my core belief, or my core desire is, and I like words, is I aspire to have a desire to live higher. And that's what's happening. In fact, sometimes it's scary, because they say that this higher power, the spiritual program, can bring stuff into your life. You know, it's kind of like Marianne Williamson talks about, we're not afraid of our fear, we're afraid of our power. And that's kind of happening. And so I have to talk to a lot of people to stay grounded and step into the light and step in the power. And if I'm not eating sugar, you know, when the sugar was there, I didn't care about anything. But now I need help being all that I can be. And it, it takes a different kind of courage, but the same courage, like coming into this meeting and sitting through all this weirdness and listening to somebody talk like this. But it takes courage. But I know the steps. I am powerless over people, places, and things. And with the other 11, I have an opportunity to live life richly, without self-hatred, without the inability to be and live fully. And so this program is a gift to us, and a lot of people miss out on this gift. And I'm a testimony that doing it totally wrong, you can still, you know, it's still worth it. And so really grateful everybody. I really am grateful everybody came, because I need to see that. Sometimes I get so discouraged thinking it's only the two of us. Marcia and I do a lot together, and I need to know, because I need the fellowship. This is an isolating thing. And so you give me a lot of hope. Thanks.